Proverbs 30, verse 24. So we'll look at kind of a short passage here, a couple verses, in light of one of the guys that we're going to study this morning. I think this would be appropriate. 30:24. Somebody pick up there.
Four things on earth are small, but they're exceedingly large.
All right, so Solomon's going to give us an illustration of four examples of things that are not significant in and of themselves, but because of their wisdom, they are able to do great things. Okay, verse 25 here is our first. Well, hello. Who's got the cover right now, by the way? No, who had it before you? You still had it. Oh, I'm sorry. Jason had it. Tony's now got it. Okay. Oh, 24 hours. That's the worst, right? Like, no one's been late for weeks. One guy gets it, and then 24 hours later, someone else is late. So. Sorry, my friend. It's good. We're raising funds for Israel right now. See, it's good. This is my Humus fund. All right. Four things. Here's the first in verse 25.
Ants are people not strong, yet they provide their food in the summer.
All right, so as you look at an individual ant, there's nothing impressive about them externally in terms of their size or what have you. They're not strong on their own, but they are able to prepare their food in summer. So what does that mean? What are they doing in summer?
Gathering
food. Why? Because they know winter's coming, right? They're smart. They know that if they don't do the small, difficult things in a season that doesn't have immediate payoff, they're not going to reap those rewards earlier. We've talked about another proverb with the same concept, okay? So in winter then, what do they have? Food, right? Now, some animals in winter, they hibernate, they leave, they go to, you know, they fly south or whatever. Ants don't have to do that, right? They have made their preparations, not exceedingly great in terms of their size, but because of their wisdom to prepare in a season where they don't need food. When they call upon that, they've got their savings banked up. Okay, so there's the first. There's your ant. Next one, 26.
The rock badgers are people not mighty, yet they make their homes in the cliffs.
All right, so we got rock badgers. Anybody got a different translation in verse 26 for rock badger? Shefanim, whatever the heck that is. Okay, what else? A coney. Okay, you guys know Coney Island? Coney Island is named after this animal. Okay, we'll see them when we get to Israel. You guys remember when we went to, where was it that had one a couple years ago? And Getty? Masada and Getty Qumran by the springs. As we walked out to the springs, there were those little like furry looking, it's like a raccoon / squirrel, small head, big bushy tail animal. Okay. They're not impressive. They're cute, but they're not going to wage war against anybody. Okay. But in their weakness, they realize where their strength is. Verse 26, where is their strength? In the rock. What does that mean? What are they doing? To protect themselves, they can hide. They can get in small places. They put their trust in something much greater than themselves, which in this case is the rock, right? So they are a rock-dwelling animal that knows where to hide in caves. It's a great illustration of us, inherently weak, but we put our faith in the sense of something much greater than us, and in that is where we end up having strength. We are not smart or strong in and of ourselves, but because of what is around us in our God, we hide in him, okay? So the rock badger or the coney is able to do that, okay? 27, how about this one?
The locusts have no king, the lizard, yet all of them march in rank.
Right, the locusts do not necessarily have a leader, okay? An individual locust, you don't need to worry about, okay? A horde of locusts, you have the Exodus, right? You have the plagues. They are amazing creatures in what they can do in numbers. I've heard they can take down an airplane, a railroad car. I mean, they will put anything in its path to stop. And they have a way that they move through. You know, the first group does X, the next group comes through and finishes it, and the last group that comes through, like, eats it to the ground. And they do that in with a cooperative sense of attacking, if you will. They don't have a leader. They just each have a job. They do it well, and they depend on the others to do their job as well, okay? So in and of themselves, a single locust, not a big deal. A horde of them, when they work together and cooperate, it's fantastic, right? It's the whole movie of ants, right? You know, it's the Pixar film. Who knew it was so biblical, okay? And here's our last one, 28.
The lizard you can take in your hands, it is in king's palaces.
The lizard, okay, anybody got a different translation for lizard? Okay, there's some confusion in the Hebrew as to whether that's lizard or spider. Okay, this is the strange stuff about Hebrew. And there's confusion as to whether it means you may grasp with your hands or it grasps with its hands. So active or passive. So the spider, though it grasps with its hands, yet it's still in king's palaces. Or it's the lizard, though you can grasp with your hand, yet it is in king's palaces. I think the NASB, the one that we just read, is I think correct in that it's showing a sign of weakness. Though there is a lizard and it's small and you can grasp it with your hands, it can end up in king's palaces. So something weak is turned into something strong. What does that mean? Though you can grasp it with your hands, it can end up in the palace of a king. What does it have the ability to do? Potentially, what is a king's palace? Is that something that everyone has access to? No. Can an army go into king's palace? Not normally, right? But a lizard can go into places that other things can't, where other things cannot go because of its size. It takes a weakness and makes it a strength, okay? So that's the idea. So four things that inherently take a weakness and turn them into a strength, okay? We're going to watch a guy this morning named Gideon. Who is that guy? He is a weak, least of his tribe type of guy who is scared. He is weak, and yet God is going to use him to do great things, and it's only in his weakness that God can demonstrate his full strength, okay? So as you guys think through your lives and your shortcomings like mine, our weaknesses so often are the things that God turns into strengths and uses to shame the wise, as Corinthians says. So if you are one of those that is inherently weak, as I think we all are, it's a good reminder that that's exactly where God wants us, and it's those weaknesses in us that God ultimately is going to redeem and demonstrate his strengths. Okay, so great nuggets on all these. Okay, so thoughts on that before we move on into Judges. I think they're so thick in number that you just can't fly through them, or it will cause a malfunction in the plane, getting the engine, so like they have to divert. So yeah, no eating of the airplane. I don't think it's just the pure power of what they're able to do in numbers. Cool. All right, judges, shall we? Jane, will you pray for us, and then we will dive into the last chapter of the story of Barak and Deborah and these guys, and then jump into Gideon here in just a second.
Father God, thanks for
a
time for us together and just dive into your word. I pray that what we learn today will change us, that we will use it to just let our lives give you glory.
Amen. All right. So you guys remember last week we were looking at the whole story of Deborah, right? One of the only female judges. Why again was she called up to be a judge? You guys remember the story? There's no men, right? Okay. Who was the guy that she partnered with? Barak. Okay. So he was kind of a sissy boy, right? He was going to go so long as he had his binky with him and Deborah, right? He needed his right-hand woman to be with him, okay? And we find out that he does indeed go, but Deborah's the hero of the story. And we get, at the end of chapter 4, the death of Sisera, the commander of Sisera's army, is killed by Jael in verse 21, yet another woman. So this is a chapter chock full of great women. You guys remember how that guy died? Yeah, the tent peg through the head, right? So he was having some warm milk and some Kenny G and fell asleep. And Jael, the soccer mom, took a tent peg and bye-bye, okay? Now, in chapter 5, as we talked about, now she's going to sing about it. So Deborah's going to write a song, okay? And they're going to sing about it. It's actually pretty funny. And Some of it not so much, okay? But it's a great reminder. This is their, if you will, this is their memorial, okay? They write a song about it. It's so much easier, right? With we see this theme through Scripture as they cross the Red Sea, that Miriam stops, and Moses, you know, they have a song that they teach the people, and it's a great tool to remember God's faithfulness. And chapter 5 is all about that. And we're going to get some insight into kind of the condition of the land and what was going on that we don't necessarily see in chapter 4. That's kind of important, okay? So this is their victory chant, if you will, okay? Chapter 5, verse 1, Deborah Barak, the son of Abinadab, however you say his name, sang that day. They're talking about the leaders of Israel, verse 3. Hear, kings, give ear. Let's see. Verse 5, the mountains quake in the presence of the Lord. You kind of get the idea that they're again, recounting what happened, okay? In verse 6, you get the names mentioned of Jael there. The travelers went about. Verse 7, here's what's happening in the condition of the land. The peasantry ceased. They ceased in Israel until I, Deborah, arose, until I arose a mother in Israel. Okay, so what does it mean that the peasantry ceased? Let's keep looking and kind of walk through that, okay? In 8, new gods were chosen. Then war was in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. What does that mean? Not a spear or a shield was seen among 40,000 in Israel. Yeah, no soldiers. Specifically, no what? Who are the soldiers? Men or women?
Men.
So there's no men that are stepping up to fight among 40,000 in Israel. Okay. New gods were chosen. So in terms of the cycle of the book of Judges, where are we? What are they doing? What is Israel punting at this point if they're choosing new gods? They're punting God, right? And they're picking up idols. So you kind of see this idea, okay? Verse 9, my heart goes out for the commanders of Israel. Verse 10, you who ride on white donkeys, you who sit on rich carpets, and you who travel on the road, sing. Meaning, we're going to sing a victory chant. You who ride on white horses is the imagery of coming back from a battle with success, which they are. But they're going to remember the fallen in the midst of this, okay? Talks about it, verse 11, at the very end, the people of the Lord went down to the gate. So there was people that were coming to fight. Verse 12, awake, O Deborah, sing a song, arise, Barak. And they're going to, again, sing this song. Notice here in verse 13 and following who came. Okay. We see verse 13, the survivors came down, to the nobles. Verse 14, from Ephraim, those who were at the root of Amalek came down. So Ephraim shows up. Verse 14, Benjamin, Makir, which is Manasseh, they come to do battle. 15, the princes of Issachar were with Deborah, also with Barak. In the valley, they rushed his heels. And look at the end of verse 15 and continuing on. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. So they're speaking of these tribes that came to do battle when Deborah and Barak called. And then of Reuben, there's this different angle, okay? Among them, there were great resolves of heart. Verse 16, why did you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the piping for the flocks? Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. What does that mean? She's pointing a finger at them and saying they didn't do something. You had great resolve of heart, but what did you do? You didn't actually show up. Where were you? Verse 16, hanging out with your sheep, right? Verse 17, Gilead or Gad remained across the Jordan. And why did Dan stay in the ships? So all these people were called to battle. Some of them came and some of them said, we're not going to come. Dan's going to hang out by the shore. Ephraim's going to hang out with their sheep. Asher's going to stay by the seashore, we see in verse 17. So she's punking the people in this song who didn't show up and then uplifting the people who did. Okay, so there's kind of this tension. Okay, verse 19, the kings came forth. They fought the kings of Canaan at the waters of Megiddo, right? The valley of Armageddon there, the Jezreel Valley that we talked about last week. And she goes on and on and on. Okay, in 24 and following, we see now specifically what happens in this battle to Sisera and the commanders. Okay, verse 24, somebody pick up there. So again, who's getting all the props in this song? Where were the men? Gone. So who gets all the, right? It's Deborah. Okay, Barak's just kind of a a trophy husband or trophy, whatever you want to call him at this point. He's just kind of there. And the women now are getting blessed. They are getting uplifted because they came in a difficult day. Okay, keep going, Melissa, in 25.
He asked for water, and she gave him milk. She brought him curds in the noble's bowl. She set her hand to the tin peg and her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera. She crushed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple.
All right, so we get a recounting of how Sisera dies. In 27, this is humorous. Read this. Why is this significant?
Between her feet, he sank, he fell, he lay still. Between her feet, he sank, he fell. When he sank,
okay, so this is repeated three times with emphasis. Why is it stated that between her feet, this commander of the army falls three times? He's bowing. What does an overtaken country do to now the new king? They bow. They're bowing at soccer mom's feet, right? It's an embarrassment that the leader of this army is being showed as one who's now being submissive to this nobody woman who's the hero of the story, okay? So it's a great picture of this guy bowing, and it's repeated for emphasis to show that, okay? Now, 28, the scene changes, okay? Now, if you wanted to know what these enemy kings were like, this is what they were like. These guys were dirty, okay? 28, it says, out of the window she looked and lamented, the mother of Sisera through the lattice. So we're going now to Sisera's mother, the guy that just died with the tent peg through his head, tent stake through his head. We're going to his mom, and she's wondering, where's my boy? He went off to battle, and he's not back yet, okay? Why does his chariot delay in verse 28 in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariots tarry? Why is he not here yet is what she's asking, okay? And then this is her answer in verse 30.
Have they not come and divided the spoil?
What does that mean? Yeah, they've conquered. So what are they doing? What's delaying them? They're counting the money, right? It's taking a while, right? What else in verse 30?
A womb or two for every man. Spoil of dyed materials for Sisera. Spoil of dyed materials embroidered. Two pieces of dyed work embroidered for the neck as spoil.
Okay, so you see all these spoils mentioned, all these things of battle that would have been taken, okay? Yours says at the very beginning, a womb, two wombs for every warrior. Mine says a maiden, two maidens for every warrior. The word is actually womb, okay? When the Hebrew's talking about God shutting down Sarah's womb, okay? That's this word, okay? It's used like 31 times in Scripture, and it's only mentioned here, translated maiden. What does that mean? A maiden, two maidens, or two wombs for every warrior. What is implied? They're raping the women. This is the mother talking about her son. He's delayed because he's probably dividing the spoil, and his warriors are raping the women of the country that they just conquered. This is a mom just talking. That would have been the normal practices in pagan countries. So again, It just paints a very real picture of what Israel was dealing with and the depth of the depravity of the people around them. So that obviously wasn't the case. Her son is obviously now attached to the earth in a very permanent way. He is not dividing spoil, nor is he hanging out with any of Israel's women. Okay. At the end of chapter 5, you see kind of the end result of this battle. Read that last part there, Melissa.
Rest for 40 years. 40
years because of the faith of Deborah to step up and fight in a tough day, and the faith of this gal that was a Midianite, right, a Kenite, one of Moses' kin from Jethro, steps up and does the right thing, even though she is neutral and from Switzerland, if you will. She fights and steps up and puts down tyranny, and the two women are the heroes of the story, okay? How many texts would you guess that are this old in this type of society where the women get to be exalted in a chapter, right? You talk about God being liberal and pro-women. There's not a lot of places where I would say that, but boy, here's one. In a right way where women get rightly exalted because the men won't step up and lead, okay? So obviously, not God's heart. I don't think that's where God would prefer women be, but it's a it's a backhanded slap to men saying, if you won't step up, boy, I can do anything and everything, and I'll use guys like Gideon, I'll use a woman to lead a country, I'll take the fiercest warrior in the land, which is a soccer mom, and they will do the dirty work if I have to. Okay, so that's now Deborah. Okay, so that is her legacy, okay? So we've seen Othniel, our first judge. Remember, that was Caleb's son, okay? We saw Ehud, the left-handed handicapped guy that rammed the king through the belly. We saw one verse on that guy, Shamgar, right? One verse, the ox goad dude who took down like 600 or whatever it was, Philistines. And now we've seen Deborah, okay? We're going to get now our fifth judge, Gideon, okay? And if you haven't been through the story of Gideon, Gideon is just a great guy, okay? This is, again, is one of those back pocket sermons that you need to have ready for a devotional or whatever. There's just so much that about him that is just absolutely fantastic. Okay, so let's look at Gideon, chapter 6, verse 1, and let's watch this new guy that God is going to use to raise up a country. 6:1, somebody pick up there.
The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of the Midian 7 years.
All right, you seen the cycle? This is like turn 5 on the clock, okay? 40 years they serve God because of Deborah. They start worshiping idols. God says, great, hands off the steering wheel for 7 years. If that's what you want, you can have it, okay? Now, who are they oppressed by? Midian. Where's Midian? East side of the Jordan. For you guys this way, okay? Moab, the Midianites, those would have been east side of the Jordan over there, okay? So these guys are on the other side over there, okay? And they are being oppressed by Midian, okay? And we're going to find out these guys are dirty, okay? And they're going to do some things that we haven't seen yet, creatively dirty. Verse 2, keep going.
And the hand of Midian overpowered Israel, and because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves the dens that are in the mountains, and the caves, and the strongholds.
Okay, so as a result of Midian's oppression of them, what do they do? What do the Israelites do in verse 2?
Hide.
They go hide in the strongholds. Okay, this would have been in the like in the Judah Mountains area. They would have retreated to places where there were natural caves and protection. Okay, so they're fearful for their lives. So what started as, oh yeah, let's worship their gods, this is fantastic, now they're fearful and they're hiding literally in caves. Verse 3, this is what they did to Israel to make them do this.
Whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. They would encamp against them and devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel and no sheep or ox or donkey.
So what do these guys do? Took everything, right? During harvest, they would come in and just destroy everything. They don't kill all the people. They take all their crops, their sheep, their oxen and donkeys, and they just kill them all and go back home. Like, oh, man. So what kind of condition is Israel in right now? They're hungry, right? They're in a famine, okay? They're scared to death of these people, and every time they try to winnow their wheat or they try to bring in their grapes, the Midianites come in and just destroy everything. So, it's just insulting, right? They're not killing people. They're just taking away their ability to live. So making them more and more dependent on Midian, okay? So it's brilliant. Now, verse 5. Let's keep reading. I'm sorry, we did that one. We didn't? Read that one. Keep going. You're good.
For their number, both they had the camels and they could not, camels could not be counted, so that they laid waste the land as they came in. Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the people of Israel cried out for help to the Lord.
Okay, and we're going to see that repeated again and again, both the crying out part and how numerous the Midianites' army was. Okay, so they were brought low. So you're seeing the cycle. They're down at the bottom now, and they're like, oh, this was a really bad idea. Okay, God is now going to raise up a prophet in verse 8. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, it was I who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. I delivered you from the hands of the Egyptians. Verse 9, verse 10, am I not the Lord your God? You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in those lands who live, but you have not obeyed me. Okay, so he brings a prophet in to remind them, you're here because you're in sin. Now, verse 11, here comes the hero of the story. Terebinth is that tree that we looked at earlier, so it's a type of tree. Keep rolling.
Which belonged to Joash that Abiezer. Well, son of Gideon was beating out wheat in winepress to hide it from the Midianites.
All right, so this is a winepress, okay, in Israel. So we've got Gideon, this guy, who's beating out wheat in a wine press, okay? That's a wine press, okay? This is in one of the cities we're actually going to go to. We won't see this one. I went to the bathroom right there. That's a restroom, by the way. Those are camels. I don't know who these guys are. But that's a wine press. So what's Gideon doing? What do you notice? Make some observations about verse 11. He's what?
Hiding.
He's hiding, okay? How do you know that? Yeah, where do you thresh wheat? When, right? Which is normally in Israel on the top of a hill, like where everyone can see, like where these camels are. You throw the wheat up in the air, and the wind that was coming by would remove the wheat from the chaff, okay? The lighter chaff, the waste stuff would blow away, the wheat would fall back to the ground, and that's how you winnowed wheat. The problem was, that's like sitting on top of a, you know, a mountaintop with a light on. Like, everybody can see me. Well, what do the Midianites do as soon as they see people threshing wheat? Great, there's our sign. Let's go in and destroy everything. So he's being creative, okay? So you've got a sunken in place, and this one is in Ein of Dot, which is this would have been part of a trade route. So normally you wouldn't see grapes obviously aren't grown in this area. You can see what it looks like. They're more often grown in the Shephelah, kind of the low hills where it's green, and you would see something like this, some type of sunken in structure where they would press the grapes. Literally, you would throw them in there, you would step on them, the grapes would kind of separate from the skins and that sort of thing, and that's where you would make wine. Okay, so Gideon's in here trying to thresh wheat. So he's doing the wrong job in the wrong place, okay, but it's a creative way, and he's doing it because he's scared, just like everybody else, and he's trying not to get found out. Okay, so God approaches him in the midst of this act, okay, that is anything but what God describes it as in verse 12.
And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor."
Okay, so how does God see Gideon? A man of valor. What does that mean? Not just a man of valor, a mighty man, a warrior. Right, is what mine says as well. Does Gideon look much like a warrior? No, he looks like a scared kid hanging out in a wine press, trying not to get found out by the Midianites so he doesn't die in battle. How does God see him? How he's what? How he's going to use him. So does God see him for how he is? No, he sees his potential, okay? One of my favorite, I'm not a big art guy, so here's all the right brain you're ever going to get out of me. One of my favorite paintings is this one, okay? René Magritte, I think is this guy's name. What? Huh?
It's a funny picture.
It is a funny picture, okay? But it has a purpose, okay? How many of you guys have seen this before? Okay, maybe one or two of you, okay? Tell me what you see, okay? The picture's title, by the way, is called Clairvoyance, okay, which is maybe not something that we believe in, but the title is significant. Walk me through what you see there.
Is he looking outside a window?
He's looking at the egg.
He's not looking out the window. He's looking at an egg. Can you see the table?
I didn't see the egg.
Good. Okay, so there's an egg on the table, okay?
He's drawing a picture of what it's going to become.
He's drawing a picture of what it's going to become. Not what it is, but what it will be, right? Clairvoyance, by definition, is the ability to, it's a sense of the ability to see things or to perceive things that are not apparent to the naked eye to anybody else, right? To me, this encapsulates exactly what God does with Gideon, okay? Gideon's an egg. Normal people that look at him, he's a scared kid hanging out in a wine press. God does not see him for what he is, but what he will be, right? It's a beautiful illustration of that. And every time I think Gideon, this is what comes to my head. So sorry if I've wrecked all of you with this silly picture now. But this to me is Gideon, right? He's a nobody. He's going to tell God that. I'm the least and the last. I'm from Manasseh, right? Who was a significant tribe, but now they're on both sides of the Jordan. We're going to see there's already trouble with them. Not only that, but he's the last of his own family within Manasseh. He's not really that special, okay? He says, "I'm an egg." And God says, "No, you're not. This is what you are. You don't realize it yet, but I've already seen this potential in you because, again, I'm sovereign and I'm God, okay?" So it's just a perfect illustration, I think, of how God sees things, okay? And this is really the story of Gideon, right? He's calling out the greatness that's within him, And obviously, God has this unique ability to do that. The other side of the story is, I think, as we talk about just aspects of leadership, this is what great leaders do. They're able to see potential in people that they may not even see in themselves, to call it out of them, to call them up to something great and say, you can do this. You have this ability. I see these fledgling talents and abilities that God has given you, and it can turn into this. And to help people see that is a unique gift of a leader. Okay, so that's why Gideon is just one of my favorite stories. Okay, all of us have these type of abilities, right? It is God given. We are promised gifts by the Holy Spirit. We may not be valiant warriors like Gideon, but each of us have gifts that God has given us. Some a few, some a lot, right? Some of you are wicked gifted at a ton of things, and your spiritual gifts are numerous. Others of us have one, maybe two, that God has said, man, that is where I have gifted you. And our job is to figure out what that is and to maximize the use of that gift, right? It's He's given us talents. Some of us are one talent people. Some of us are 10 talent people. And it's not the amount of the talent that matters. It's how well you use what you've been given, right? It's not, God is not looking for to outpoint your coverage, if you will. He's asking you to thrive in the areas that you've been put and to use your talents to the best of the ability, because it's God that gave them to you anyway. Okay, so as you think through Gideon, just keep this picture in the back of your mind. Okay, so scared boy, verse 12, oh valiant warrior. And then Gideon now is going to answer back in verse 13.
Why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hand of Midian.
So what's the assumption there in verse 13?
His dad is actually teaching him.
Yeah, there's a cool little ditty in that he's got information. And you're going to find out his dad is he's an idol worshiper. There's some sense of godliness that he knows. He's heard the stories of what's happened in you know, days gone by. Okay, what else do you see? Contrast that with verse 12. What is Gideon not able to see? Why? My circumstances say that God is not here, because all he can see is this. All he focuses on is the difficulty, the pain that they're in. We're in a famine. We have an enemy that's oppressing us. Where are you, God? And God says, I've never left. You guys abandoned me. Okay, I am still very much here. I never abandoned you. You chose to walk away from me in a sense. This is a self-inflicted gunshot wound. You guys did stupid, and now you want to blame me for it, right? So he can't see outside of his own circumstances to realize, no, God is still sovereign. God is still there. He's still very much in control, but he's allowing this to happen to humble us. Yeah, Pete.
In a sense, he's so like focused on what their circumstances. He doesn't even see God himself. Because he says, please, sir, the Lord is with us.
Right.
And, you know, like.
Buddy, you're talking to God, right? Yeah. Hello. Yeah. And man, how many times are we guilty of that, right? You focus on the circumstances that are around you and you completely get tunnel vision and you forget that God's in control. And each of us have different maybe triggers that make that happen, stresses in our life that cause us to go, oh, crud. Like, if I don't solve this problem, if I don't like whatever, then man, each of us has different areas that, again, that cause us those stresses. I know what mine are. You know, I start looking at the bank account numbers in my nonprofit, and there's like a magic number in the back of my head that everything's going to be okay as long as we're at this number or above. But as soon as we get underneath that number, it's like, oh, you God, how are we going to do this? I just don't know. And, you know, I realize, no, like, that's me freaking out. And that's me putting my eyes on my circumstances and looking at the water instead of Christ that's walking on the water, right? We all are capable and are guilty of those things. Okay, and that's exactly where Gideon's at. He is not a valiant warrior, okay? But he will be, okay? So, 14, this is God's call to him.
And the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian.
Like, what? You're not here. I'm not a warrior. Now you want me to go do, like, God, you're not listening to me, right? That's kind of the idea. Have I not sent you? Go in this your strength, meaning I haven't abandoned you. I'm still here, okay? And Gideon's still a little confused, 15.
And he said to him, please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house.
Like, he just, are you aware of the circumstances, God, exactly what's going on, who I am, what's going on, like, have you been gone for 7 years? Like, it was great when Deborah was here for 40, but now we're oppressed. This is no bueno, and I'm not your guy, okay? And you're going to see this repeated over and over with Gideon. And I think what I appreciate about this is God never, he never gets condemned for having this lack of trust. He needs, God realizes how weak he is, and he's like, I got it, okay? You're scared, and he honors that here and then again further on in the story, okay? 16. Now God answers back.
And the Lord said to him, I will be with you, and you shall strike the Midianites as one man. And he said to him, if now I have found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me.
Okay, so I need a sign, right? We're going to see this is Gideon's kind of life, right? I need a sign. I need to touch it. I need to feel it. This is doubting Thomas, right? 18, keep going.
Please do not depart from here until I come to you and bring out my presence and set it before you. And he said, I will stay till you return.
So an odd request. Okay, so you're going to make dinner. And God says, okay, I'll hang out. You know, we'll barbecue. Good deal. Okay, 19.
So Gideon went into his house and prepared a young goat and unleavened cake from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket and the broth he put in a pot and brought to him under the terebinth and presented them. And the angel of God said to him, take the meat and unleavened cake and put them on this rock and pour the broth over them. And he did so. The angel of the Lord reached out, and the tip of the staff that was in his hand touched the meat and the unleavened cakes. And the fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and unleavened cakes. And the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight.
Like, I thought we were just going to hang out and eat, and you just made this an offering, and you consumed it in a burnt offering, and now you're gone? Like, Gideon's standing there going, what the heck? Like, he's kind of dumbfounded. Gideon saw this in verse 22. Here's his response.
Then Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Lord. And Gideon said, alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face.
So it took him a little bit more, right? I think it's a proven medical fact that men's brains are actually slightly thicker, or skulls are slightly thicker than women's, okay? That's Gideon, okay? He needed a little bit of a push to go, like Pete said, do you realize who you're talking to? Like, I'm not just some guy that walked in from, like, Ephraim next door and said, hey, here's what we should do. This is the Lord that you're talking to. And it finally comes through, okay? Lord said to him in verse 23, peace to you, do not fear, you shall not die, which, again, is fascinating. When people stand before the angel of the Lord and when it all clicks, what is their first response? I am going to die. And not out of, like, again, this guy's evil or bad. It's, man, I am standing in the presence of holiness of God himself, and I am not. You're immediately aware of your own inadequacies and sin, and just, I love that fact. So Gideon fully gets it. Like, okay, the light bulb is at like 100 lumens right now. He's finally catching on. Yeah, apparently. So you figure it out. Okay, but yeah, now they're having a conversation again. Okay.
It's funny that he believed once his food was missing.
You took my food, dude. I'm hungry. Wait a second. We're in a famine and you just burn up my food. Yeah, so wait a second. If I get a belief, will you give me dinner? 24, keep going. All right, so we're going
to
see that he builds now this altar, which is a great response. 25, God is now going to ask him to do something crazy.
That night the Lord said to him, take your father's bull and the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it. And build an altar to the Lord your God on the top of the stronghold here, with stones laid in due order. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah that you shall cut down.
All right, so what is God's charge to Gideon?
Take down all the pagan worships.
Okay, of Baal and Asherah, like the two filthy, McNasty gods. Tear them down, and then what else? What are you going to do after you do that? You're going to take your father's bull. You're going to build an altar on top of that. In fact, you're going to use the scraps from the altar that you tore down to now build an offering to God. Okay, where is this? According to verse 26, 25. The altar which belongs to your father. Where is this? It's in Gideon's backyard, right? That's his home. Why is that significant? God is going to call him to lead a country. He is a judge. He's going to call all of Israel back to repentance. Before you start, Gideon, here's what I want you to do. Go into your backyard, tear down your father's altar. Build an altar for God. Start there. Why is that significant? He starts at home. Okay, what's the illustration of that? What's the application of that, if you will? Why is that so important that God would say, no. Before you lead Israel, first you're going to have to lead at home.
So people will see what he does and follow his example.
Yeah. Okay. Now, could they have done that on a grand scale? I mean, could they have seen that with Israel in terms of his leadership and what he stands for? And, hey, I'm for God. Certainly. So why does God make him start specifically with his dad's altar in his backyard? Which one's the grander scale? Israel, right? Leading the whole country, right? Which he's going to do. So why is that significant? Yep. Okay. Yeah, you got to lead at home. It's another requirements for an elder in Timothy, right? The idea is, look, if you can't lead your household, how can you lead the church? If you can't lead on a small scale, what makes you think you can lead on this scale? Are your children godly? Like, are you leading at home, right? If not, then don't bother leading up here, right? If it don't work at home, we talk about in seminary all the time, don't export it. That's the idea. So Gideon has to take a stand in front of his family. Now, for those of you guys that have ever had these conversations that maybe didn't grow up in a church home, came to Christ, and you were one of the first people in your family to come to know the Lord, where is the most difficult place to do evangelism? At home. With your parents, right? They know you. They know your faults. They know your issues, right? They wiped your rear end when you grew up, right? They know everything about you, all your shortcomings, and now you're going to tell them about the God that they should worship. Like, you know it all, wet behind the ears, right? It's difficult. And Gideon has to take a stand at home. And that had to be really, really hard. There's something, in a sense, a lot easier about getting shipped off to a foreign country and sharing the gospel and nobody knows you. But that's not where God lets Gideon start.
How old is he? Is he old enough to be taking a stand like that at home? Or his dad has been?
It seems like it. I mean, he's old enough to be a warrior. We don't get his age. But he's still living at home, so he's not married. So I would guess, yeah, he's probably late teens, young 20s, something around in there. I mean, he's y'all's age, right, for the most part. So, okay. So remember that, okay? How would you apply this, Mo? How about in student ministry? Junior hires, high schoolers that have great aspirations to do great things for God. What's the application from Gideon's life here? How would this apply to an eighth grader's life? They're Christians. They want to do great things for God. They want to be missionaries overseas.
They need to start with their schools.
Yeah, start at home. Start where it's most difficult, right? Try walking with Christ in a middle school. I mean, that's hard, right? I got a daughter that's trying to figure that out and get her bearings straight in a school that, man, that's not cool. That's not honored. How do you talk about your faith in those environments and represent Christ well, you know, knowing that could be, you could be ostracized and what have you. So when your dad's a pastor and, right, it's hard. I didn't have to grow up with that pressure. That's really, really difficult. So think through that. Okay. As you guys are talking through, folks, it's got to start at home. Your faith has to be there first. Okay. And then it moves out from there. Small circles concentrically will move out. So Layla, do you have a thought? It seems like I think it's for the altar. We're going to find out in 27. Gideon grabs some buddies, 10 men, and they're going to do that together. Okay, so I think they're for sacrificial purposes. Okay, Cool. It's 27, Layla. Speaking of, pick up there. So just Gideon do it? Absolutely. When does he do it? At 2 in the morning, right? All right, everybody come over. Be really quiet, okay? We're going to tear down this altar. So do you see his faith, like how fledgling it is? He knows it's the right thing to do, but he's not going to do it at noon, right, where everyone can see it. He's not doing it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon at dinner time and like, hey, look at me, right? He's scared to death. Okay, nobody's going to know. They're going to go to bed with this altar to Baal. They're going to wake up. It's gone. And that was an altar built to the Lord. And everyone's going to go, what the heck just happened? Right? That wasn't there when we went to bed last night, but now it's there.
When the altar, like, anybody would look at it and they're like, oh, that's for the Lord. Is there like
apparently, and I don't know what that was, but yes, it was very apparent based on the reactions of the people that something clearly happened and something was torn down and something else was erected in its place. One was for Baal and one was for Yahweh, and it was that clear.
They wouldn't have just thought, oh, that's just a different model of the one for
Baal. Yeah, so figure out what that is. I don't know. I don't know externally what they look like. We're going to see some stuff in Israel. There are often what they'll call standing stones. That are used to worship or used to represent like false gods. And they would literally erect like these big long stones, and these stones would represent gods that they would worship. And you could look at that site and go, that's pagan. Like you can walk up and go, that's not of God. That is a sign of a false deity worship there of whatever kind. So, you saw that like the tension in the end of book of Joshua with an altar, and it's like, okay, which altar is that? So that one was confusing. Apparently, as they developed, there were certain things that you would see that were with Baal and with the Asherah that were clearly theirs, and you did not replicate those. Standing stones were one of those, okay? And we're going to go to, either we'll study it here before we get to Israel, and we'll show you guys some of those things that were marks of pagan stuff, okay? So whatever this was, it was clearly not of them.
Yeah, do we have any idea what these look like? Because I'm imagining just like a little thing.
Yeah, and that's in a lot of cases, that's it, right? When we talk about the rock pile that Joshua made, it's 12 rocks stacked together. It's not that significant. It would have fit on one of those tables. Some of these are bigger, like in Gezer, in one of the cities that we'll see, the standing stones were 20 feet tall, sometimes taller than that, and there were four of them, and they were these big structures that you could see up on a hilltop so that everyone looking up from miles away could go, that's the place where we go worship. So they were all a little bit different. Some of them were big, some of them were small. So it kind of depends on where we are and what they were worshiping, okay? Asherahs often had a pole, an Asherah pole. So think almost like totem pole-esque, right, that they would go worship. Okay, the imagery isn't the same. It's not good, but that's the idea, okay? So, that's what I love about Gideon, right? You see his faith, like, he's got a little, right? I know this is the right thing to do, but I'm going to do it in the middle of the night, and I'm going to call over all my buddies to do it with me. So, you just, like, okay, I identify a lot with that. I'm like, okay, Gideon, right? Good for you. That's how the rest of us really feel in that situation. Okay, 28, keep going. Okay, so they see these, right? The Baal altar is gone. The Asherah pole has been cut down. So these are the actual visual things that they're like, something's off. And then there's this bull that's been offered, right? A slaughtered bull on an altar. Okay, and that's apparently not how they would have worshipped. Keep going.
And they had said to one another, who has done this thing? And after they had searched and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing.
Well, so why did Gideon do it in the middle of the night? So nobody would know, okay? A verse later, they're like, wait a second, problem. Who did this? Oh, Gideon. What do you think their next response is going to be? Yeah. Right? Like, that. Gideon's like, oh, no, right? So God honors that faith for him to do it in the middle of the night, but God also puts him in the spot where he intentionally gets found out. And you're going to watch. This is crazy who steps up and saves Gideon's rear end in this situation, okay? So they find out, yep, Gideon's your boy, okay? Verse 30, keep going.
Okay.
Okay, so Joash is Gideon's dad, and they say to him, bring him out, we're going to kill him. He tore down the altar in your backyard, and now we're going to put him to death. Now, Joash is, though he's an idol worshiper, he's brilliant. Okay, 31 is a great response.
But Joash said to all who stood against him, will you contend for Baal, or will you save him? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down.
All right, so put that in Living Bible for me. What is Joash saying in regards to Baal? Yeah, if he's powerful, he'll step down. Okay, give a little more.
If he's powerful, he would have stopped it from being torn down.
Yeah, like if we're going to worship this God, if he's worthy of our worship, does he really need us to defend him? Like, he can defend himself. So if he really is as powerful as y'all say he is, let him take care of his own business, right? He's a God, right? So you see the response? Now they're in a tough spot. Well, yeah, he is. Well, if they agree with that, then they can't kill Gideon. If they say, no, he's not, then they're admitting the fact that he's really not a god to begin with, so we shouldn't be worshiping him in the first place. So he's brilliant, okay? And that's exactly what they do, okay? They're 32 on that day. They named him Jerubbaal. That's Gideon's name, which basically means let Baal contend for himself, right? So they renamed Gideon Jerubbaal, meaning if Baal has a problem with Gideon, then let Baal contend for himself, okay? So that's his new name. It's kind of a cool name. Let Baal contend for him because he has torn down his altar. So the guys in this like heated moment, they all got pitchforks and, you know, torches with them. They back down because of Gideon's dad, who, again, isn't a fan of Gideon's God, but he's a fan of Gideon, right? That's my son. So that's the idea. So anyway, his dad steps in, and you can see, like, obviously he doesn't want his kid to die, but he does not worship Gideon's God, okay? Let's keep going in 33. Let's now watch what God does.
Amalekites, and the people of the east came together, and they crossed the Jordan, and encamped in the valley of Jezreel.
Okay, so now they're coming back over, so what time must it be if the Midianites are coming over into Israel's land? Yeah, there's harvest of something, right? So there's food on the table, or getting ready to be, and God says, we need to deal with this, okay? 34.
So the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet, and the Abiezrites were called out to follow him.
So, what's Gideon doing right now? 33 and 34, what does he do?
He warns everybody,
he's getting ready. And what's the response of the people? Yeah, so what are you seeing in Gideon? He's leading, right? It starts on a really small scale at home, and he has some success and goes, okay, like I had to do it at 2 in the morning, but God was faithful. So now I'm going to blow the trumpet and let's see what happens. Here come the Midianites. Nobody else is stepping up. I'm going to blow the trumpet, and I'm going to rally the troops. Who comes? People come. Like, okay. You can see God just giving him a little bit each time. He doesn't have this huge faith, but the object of his faith is huge, and we're seeing his leadership savvy rise. We're seeing his confidence in what God can do arise, right? He saw himself at the beginning as some scared kid, and God says, no, you're a valiant warrior. You know, don't worry about it. And certainly, that's what he is, okay?
Could it be that they see... You know, because you know how his name was changed. You know, let Baal contest for himself, and so they're like, "Oh, Baal didn't do anything to Gideon, so we're gonna listen to him because right now he has favor. Baal has favor on Gideon. Could that be part?"
I think they probably would have taken it like the first part of like, "Oh, Baal didn't do anything, so maybe this guy actually has the favor of God." So they're oppressed, so they don't want to follow Baal anymore because what was a great benefit no longer is. So I think it was kind of like it was a jab at Baal. Oh, okay. That's what his name meant. It's like, really, Baal? You want some of this? Come get it. Like, that's basically what his name is. Like, if you're capable, by all means, take me down. Oh, nothing? Let's go, guys. That's my understanding of it. Okay? All right. So he sent messengers out, verse 35, through Manasseh. They also called together to follow him. Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, they came up to meet him. So people are people are responding. Like, okay, this guy's got some leadership savvy in him. 36, Gideon now says, if you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken. So what's he doing now? All right, God, we started at 1. I'm at like a 3. Okay, I'm really trying. Okay, but I need to know that you're in this. Okay, like yesterday you were great, but today's a new day. So if you're really going to deliver Israel, I need a sign. I need to touch it. I need to feel it. I need some reassurance here. So what's his plan? I'm going to take, you know, like a sheep's wool. I'm going to lay it on the ground, right? And if I wake up in the morning and this is wet and the ground's dry, then I'm going to know you're God. I have no idea where that came from. Like, that was his idea, okay? And it was so. 38, when he arose the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece in a bowl full of water. So he's like, I asked for a sign. God gave me the sign. Gideon went, wait a second. That actually wasn't the sign I wanted. Okay, 39, keep going.
Then Gideon said to God, let not your anger burn against me. Let me speak just once more. Please let me test you just once more with the fleece. Please, let it be dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground let there be dew.
So what is he saying now? Let's do the opposite. Why? Just in case. Like, maybe that was a fluke. Maybe it was like dew, and it was just got a here and not there. So he's like, let's do the opposite. Maybe that would be, in his mind, harder. So make the ground wet and the fleece dry, right? Because if the ground was wet, then everything would be wet. And sure enough, verse 40.
And God did so that night, and it was dry on the fleece only, and on all the ground there was dew.
Like, all right, Gideon, what you going to do now? Like, God's done twice now, same miracle, like, take 2, and he does it, and he's faithful. So now Gideon's like, okay, I've seen what I need to see. Let's step up, okay? So verse 7, Rachel, read that. You'll like this. Or chapter 7, verse 1.
Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Harod.
Where?
Harod.
Where's that?
I don't remember.
Yes, you do.
There were so many springs.
You remember the tickle fish?
What?
You remember the tickle fish?
Yes, ew, stop. I remember him screaming like a girl, actually.
I have no recollection of that. I think you're lying. Anyway, we went there. Tickle fish.
You'll see.
Oh, no. That I will not ruin that for you, okay? If we don't go there, remind me. I'll tell you the story. Rachel's being dishonest. We don't need to talk about that anymore, so she can repent of her sin later. I think there is. Okay. It's a fun sight. Okay. Hopefully we'll get to see it this year. Okay. Maybe. All right. So they're camping in this place. Keep going.
And the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh Valley.
All right. So they're in the Jezreel Valley. They're on the south side of the valley. Okay. So north would have been, how about we just look at a map? I got one. Where did you go? You don't play nice. It's a leopard. Wakey, wakey. There we go. Okay. TV card. Hi. All right. All right. So, Jordan River, you with me? Okay. Sea of Galilee up here. This is the Jezreel Valley, right? We've seen that before. Okay, so they're in this big fighting valley. Here's the Harod Valley right here. Here's the Harod Spring. And this is where they're going to now fight. Okay, so Nazareth is right up here. Megiddo, you see right in the corner. So just to kind of orient you, this is where the battle is about to go down. So they are camped at the Harod Spring. Okay, they would have camped there obviously because there was water. And we're going to find out why here in just a minute. Okay, now God's going to up the ante a little bit. He keeps working Gideon, right? He's scared, and God's like, oh, buddy, you don't know the half of it. Verse 2.
The Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. For Israel would become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me.
Okay, so Gideon rallies the troops. What's the problem in God's eyes? You rallied too many. Like, great job, but way too many, right? Now, Midian's really small and a weak army, correct? What did we just read about them? They're mighty. They're more numerous than the sand of the seashore. They can't count them. Like, pardon? God, we're still way outnumbered, and now you don't like how many people I brought? Like, okay. So God says, no, 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 we need to whittle these people down. Okay, so verse 3, here's God's plan.
Now therefore come proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. So 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained.
So they got 32,000 people that had Gideon rallies, and two-thirds of them go, yep, scared, going home. Done. Thanks. Appreciate the exit, you know, ramp. That's exactly what I wanted. So now Gideon has got himself and 10,000 guys, which compared to Midian is not a lot, okay? And then God says, okay, good job. Now let's keep going. Verse 4.
Then the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Therefore, it shall be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, he shall go with you. But everyone of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go.
All right, so they take the 10,000 people down to the water. They all get in, okay? And the ones that don't scream when the ticklefish get them, they get to stay, okay? That's actually not how it happens, okay? Anyway, verse 5, God says, you got too many. Take them all down to the water, and here's how we're going to test them, okay? You shall separate, in verse 5, everyone who laps water with his tongue as a dog laps, and one who kneels to drink. Okay, so two different styles. One's going to drink from the spring like a dog laps water, and the other one is going to kneel to drink. How does a dog lap water? 4 feet, and what do? Stick your face in the water. The Hebrew word actually is like an onomatopoeia, right? You remember those? It sounds like, okay? And when you say the word, it actually sounds like lapping. I forget what the word is. Anyway, so it's like if they do this, and we don't have that in English, right? If they lap, that's actually the word that it makes when they're drinking water. Okay, so one drinks like a dog. The other group, what's the impression that you get from kneels to drink? Yeah, water to the hand. And that's literally what it means. You're drinking with the water from your hand. So what's the difference in those two? You've got 10,000 guys that are getting ready to go to battle, okay? There's one group that sticks their face down in the water and drinks that way. There's another group that brings their hand to their mouth.
When you do that, you can, like, see what's happening.
Yeah. Right? So there's a group of guys that, idea is they probably have a sword in one hand, and they're watching as they drink, okay? They're going to be the minority. In fact, 300 of them. 9,700 of them stick their face in the water. 300 guys remain that have their head on a swivel and are looking around and prepared to fight, okay? And God says, perfect, okay? So here's the original 300 in verse 6. The number of those who lap, putting their hand in their mouth, was 300 men, but the rest of the people kneeled to drink water, okay? And Gideon is told by God, yep, that's who I want right there. I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and will give the Midianites into your hands. So unlike the battle of the original or the second 300, they lose. These guys are going to win, okay? So let's turn this into a movie. That would be super cool. Anyway, okay, so verse 8, God says, great. So we started at 30,000, 32,000, and now we have less than 1% of the original people that were called by God. You got to think Gideon's like, man, Lord, do you have any idea how hard it was for me to muster up the courage to call these people? And you sent 99% of them home. I got 300 dudes left in me. How are we going to do this? This is the Midianites, right? And God's like, yep, I got you exactly where I want you, okay? Verse 9, that same night, the Lord came to him and says, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands, okay? But if you are afraid to go down, bring with you this guy named Purah, your servant, and go down to the camp. Okay, so he says, you guys are camped on opposite deals. We've sent everybody home. Before you go to battle, I want you to go down to their camp at night. If you're afraid, take your buddy with you, okay? Verse 11, watch what happens.
You shall hear what they say, and afterwards your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outposts of the army. Men who were in the camp.
Okay, so they come upon the Midianite camp. Who does he bring with him? So is he still scared? Absolutely. He doesn't go by himself. So you see, again, he's taking steps, but he's not like, he's not there. And that Gideon never gets there, okay? Verse 12, watch what happens.
And the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, so the sand that is on the seashore in abundance.
How do you think Gideon's, when you crest the hill and you look down at their camp and go, oh my gosh, like, Literally, it's like watching the Persian army rolling from the sea. You're like, you've got to be kidding. I mean, there's 300 of us, and I can't even begin to count them. Like, this is bad news, okay? 13, keep going.
When Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade, and he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat.
A loaf of barley bread, right? You guys ever seen like a tumbleweed rolling through West Texas? They're these really small, insignificant, lightweight things. They don't take over tents, right? Ever. Even these lightweight structures, they can't. And what happens in this dream? This little small thing wrecks the thing it should never wreck. And Gideon goes, that's God, right? He revealed this dream. So he hears these two guys in the camp talking about this dream. In verse 14, his friend says, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian into... given Midian and all the camp into his hand. So his buddy says, Gideon, that's the sign. Like, that's what we wanted. This is prophecy from God. And Gideon's able to go, okay, right? And he needs another guy to kind of fill in the blanks for him. But that's the idea. Okay, verse 15, keep going.
As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hands. And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put trumpets in the hands of all of them and empty jars with torches inside the jars.
All right, so 15, what's he do? He's got faith, right? You see his countenance change? He went down there because he was scared. He had to take Purah with him. Purah says, man, that's the dream. Absolutely, that's from God. He comes back into the camp. What's his countenance like now? Dude, he's like, dude, it's on. God has given them. It's already happened. They are in our hands, okay? Verse 16, what does he do? What are their weapons of warfare here?
Trumpets.
Trumpets. Torches and, like, pottery. Literally, that's what you would make. Like, this is hardened clay or whatever. They're taking pictures with them and torches and trumpets. Odd, okay? Verse 17, kind of here's Gideon's, man, this is a shining moment.
Do
as I do. Do you see how far Gideon's come in his leadership? Watch me. I will now lead, okay? When we get to the outskirts of the camp, put your eyes on me and just follow what I do, okay? So you see him. Man, it takes him a bit to get there, but his leadership savvy and his strength, his trust in God is continuing to increase. He's never going to be the most valiant of all leaders, but man, this is exactly what God wants, and now he's got the confidence to do it, okay? And here's the plan, verse 18. Okay, so what is the plan in 18? We're going to make a ton of noise, right? This is kind of like Jericho, right? We're going to shout. We're going to make a ton of noise on the last day. What's the difference, though, between this picture and the picture of Jericho? How many people were coming up on Jericho when they walked into the land? A bunch, right? Some of the women and children, obviously, were still at home, but we got a bunch of fighting dudes, right? We got 300 now. So why is Gideon telling them, shout? Okay, verse 19, Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came up to the outskirts of the camp, beginning in the middle watch. Middle watch would have been later at night when they had posted the watch and they blew trumpets and smashed their pitchers that were in their hands. Okay, smashing pitchers, screaming, making a ton of noise in the middle of the night. Making them sound bigger, right? They can't see how many people are there. But boy, from the amount of noise that they're creating, smashing of pottery and jars in the middle of the night, it sounds really big and really intimidating, right? That's their fear. So they're playing on the Midianites' fear. If they can see them, they're like, there's 300 of you, right? That's laughable. But they can't see them. So again, taking their weakness and turning it into a strength, okay? And that's how God does it, okay? When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, and again, you've got a company here doing this, a company on the other side of the camp over here doing this, and another company on the other side of the camp doing it here. So they're surrounded. They're everywhere. No, there's 100 guys in each place, but they sound like thousands based on the amount of noise that they're making. So they're thinking, what? We got a lot of people. But we're surrounded, right? We see torches, and maybe those are just the beginning of the torches, that, right? So they see 300 torches, but and hear these the sounds and the noises, okay? Keep going in verse 20.
And the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon.
So they rally, man. They are amped, and they're ready to go to battle, okay? Pete, keep reading in 21.
For every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew their 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And all the army fled as far as Bethsheba toward the river. As far as the border of...
Yeah, they run far away. Okay, that's what they do. How does the battle go down? Every man's sword against another. What does that mean? It's chaos. Well, wrong guy, my bad. You know, there's panic in the camp, right? They're rubbing the sleep out of their eyes. They're waking up. There's noise. There's torches. And they are panicked from 300 guys. And they have tens of thousands, okay? So they get chased. Oh, really? We're going to do this again? All right. They get chased all the way across the Jordan River. So they make this huge... They flee and go back basically home to Midian. I will show you. There we go. Okay, so the battle occurs here. They go next to Bet Shean through this valley all the way down the Jordan River and then cross over at Sukkoth. Okay, and this story will be important here in just a second in the next chapter. Okay, so they run the enemy out of town. They're done. Okay, so keep going. Where do we finish off? 23. The men of Israel summoned Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, and they pursued Midian, so they get more people coming on. 24. Pete, keep rolling there.
Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites and capture the waters against them, as far as Bethphara and also the Jordan.
All right, so he rallies now the guys from Ephraim. Okay, so for whatever reason, he doesn't invite them initially. He says, come now and help us pursue these guys. So all the men of Ephraim were summoned. They come, and they now captured, verse 25, the two leaders of Midian. Okay, here are their names, Oreb and Zeb. Okay, and they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. Okay, so the winepress that we saw earlier, they kill the two leaders of the Midianites, and they pursue the rest of these people. Now, 8:1, the Ephraimites are ticked at Gideon. This is an odd response, okay, but here's their deal. 8:1, read that.
This that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian, and they accused him fiercely.
Okay, so what's their beef with Gideon? Yeah, dude, you went to battle. You didn't even pick up the phone and call us. The battle's won. You're chasing people out of town, and now you call us and say, "Hey, come help us do the cleanup work," basically, right? So they didn't get to participate in any of the fun stuff, right? That's kind of their attitude, and they're. They contended with him vigorously. They're angry. So you've got Gideon, who's exhausted, who's been fighting a battle, and now one of his own countrymen are barking about the fact that they didn't get to be in the limelight? Like, really? Watch Gideon's response. This is brilliant. Verse 2, watch what he does.
What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not that gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of the Bezer? God has given you into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?
Okay, so what is he saying? Read between the lines. How does he handle the situation?
Saying you have all the glory.
You guys have all the glory. In fact, what have I been able to do in comparison to you? Look what you've done. You've captured the leaders. You killed their kings. Y'all are freaking awesome. You see how he deflects it? He doesn't go tit for tat with them. He doesn't feel like the need to say, well, I didn't, you know, and be defensive. He says, man, you guys are great. In fact, you have even more glory than I do. You captured their leaders. Y'all are bad, right? That's kind of his response. So he is able to deflect their anger by exalting them. He's like, I don't care if my face is on the front page of the paper. Y'all are great. We won the battle. You did a great job. And he exalts them. It's just a great leadership nugget. He doesn't feel the need to defend himself. He doesn't feel the need to be exalted or to be more honored than they are. He's like, no worries. Like, y'all are great, okay? And he doesn't apologize for not calling him. He's like, man, that was just, it is what it is. Y'all are great. Okay, so he deflects it and does a great job. And as a result, they're like, okay. Then their anger toward him subdued when he said that. Absolutely. So two verses. And all the, now these guys realize, yeah, you know what, he's right. We are pretty important. We kill those guys. You know, so it's like, absolutely. Okay, so great leadership. Verse 4, keep going. Exhausted yet pursuing. Like, that was my theme verse through seminary. Like, just keep going, right? Exhausted, right? And some of you guys, you know what I'm talking about when you're in those seasons of life where you just got responsibilities, a lot's going on. That's where Gideon's men are. They're like, man, we are fried. We want to stop. We need to eat. We want to drink. We just need a day off, but it's not time. You got to keep the hammer down. And, man, that's kind of their life. Okay, weary yet pursuing is what my text says. And I just, man, I remember seasons in life that that's just how it felt, right? When you're that season, man, I remember young kids that weren't sleeping through the night, you know, and you're trying to be sanctified at 2 in the morning, and one of you is kicking the other to get out of bed and go feed that crying baby, and you're like, if you cry one more freaking time, kid, like, what is wrong with you? You're fed, you're dry, like, ah, I just want to sleep. I got to get up at 3 in the morning, or whatever. It's just maddening. In their seasons of life, in all, you know, facets, single, married, whatever, that are just like that, and you feel like these guys do, just exhausted, but you can't stop yet, right? We've all been there, okay? Verse 5, weary yet pursuing, here's what they need to do. Zamunda. All right, so it sounds like it should be like a cartoon king's name or something. All right, so they come to Sukkoth. Okay, this is where Jacob was. You guys remember Penuel, this area of land. Okay, these guys are friends. Okay, so they come into Sukkoth. They're exhausted. They need a meal. They need a drink of water, and they need to keep going. So they come to the guys in Sukkoth and say, hey, will you feed my men? Okay, now there's 300 of them. There's a few, but there's not a million. Give us some bread, okay? And their response, these guys are chumps, okay? Verse 6, this is their answer.
The officials of Sukkoth said, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army?
What does that mean? Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? Have you conquered them yet? Mm-hmm. Meaning what?
They're just being lazy.
No, you didn't know
they might be charged
loyalty. Yeah. Who do we know to be loyal to? Have you already defeated them? If we feed you, then whose side are we on? Your side. And if you guys lose that battle, now what's going to happen to us? They're going to come kill us. So, whoa, you know, do you have their heads in a sack yet? Like, are these kings dead? Then don't expect anything from us. We're Switzerland. We don't want anything to do with you. That's basically their answer. So they're totally copping out. And Gideon says, I'll remember that. You don't want to play nice? You don't want to take care of my men who are weary and exhausted? I will remember that. We're going to go win this battle, and when we're done, we're going to come pay Sukkoth a visit. Okay, so that's the idea. Gideon says, all right, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with thorns of the wilderness and with briars. I'm going to come back. I'm going to put your hands on the chalkboard, and I'm going to pull out my fraternity paddle, and I'm going to spank your hineys. It's like, I'm going to embarrass you, I'm going to shame you, and after I'm done with that, I'm going to kill you. That's his answer. I'm not just going to chop off your heads. I'm going to embarrass you, and I'm going to thrash your bodies with thorns. And then when I'm done, we'll kill you. Okay? So he's like, you know, he needs a little sugar, right? Blood sugar's low. He's a little frustrated, right? I've been there. Get a little grumpy. He's hungry. I will be much more spiritual if you feed me. He's mad. And not just mad for himself. Who is he defending? His men. And I like that about Gideon. He's mad because the guys that are coming to fight aren't being taken care of. So this isn't about my honor. This is about my men who you are not going to take care of. Okay. So I like Gideon. He fights for the right stuff. Okay. So he says, great. That's how you want to handle it. We'll do that. Okay. Verse 9, he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return safely, I will tear down your tower. Like, I'm going to come destroy you and your town. We're going to ransack this place, okay? Sure enough, how do you think God handles this, okay? Zeb and Zalmunna were in Karkor, which is, again, way off to the southeast over here. So they're back in their homeland, and they are running away. 15,000 men, all who were left in the entire army in verse 10, and 120,000 had already fallen. Okay, verse 11, let's watch how this goes down.
Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic.
All right, so they come in basically backdoor, attack this army who thinks they're secure. They're in their hometown. Gideon comes in with his 300 men, defeat yet another army, get the two kings, and now is going to rout them. Okay, 13, Gideon the son of Joash returned from the battle, from the ascent of Harry. So this is one of the routes to come back into town. They've won this battle, so now where is he going back to? Sukkoth, verse 14, keep reading.
And he captured a young man of Sukkoth and questioned him, and he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Sukkoth, 77 men.
Why does Gideon care about that? He captures a guy from Sukkoth and says, write down for me all of the leaders of your hometown. Because those are the 77 guys that said, the heck with you. We're not going to feed you. Write them all down. I want every last name. He's not going to kill innocent people. He's going to kill the people that said, we want nothing to do with you, and we're not on your team. We should be, but we're not. Okay? So, verse 15, watch what he does.
And it came to the men of Sukkoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, are the heads of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?
Oh, you mean these guys right here? Were these the guys you were talking about that we had defeated in battle? Zeba and Zalmunna right here? These guys, yeah? Oh, look, we have them now, right? I mean, just punking them. You taunted me, that's the word he says in verse 15, right? You mocked me, and for mocking me, now I will mock you. Here are the guys that you were so concerned that we couldn't defeat. By the way, their army's back there, they're all dead. Okay, God defeated them. So you can see, verse 16, keep going. I mean, it's such a great, like, he takes these leaders of the city and just absolutely humiliates them. Mine says, discipline them, right? It's just, you get the picture. It's like, man, I'm going to treat you like a 12-year-old kid who just got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, right? And, you know, it's just old school. Whoosh, whoosh, right? They get spanked, okay? Literally spanked. 17, he tore down the Tower of Penuel and he killed the men of the city. So, that's what you wanted. That's what you're going to get. Okay, next time, trust God.
So he spanks them and then kills them?
Yep. Yep. It's dirty, right? So it's just, I like Gideon, right? I know. You're like, I kind of like Gideon. He's just, I like
his,
that.
So. Confidence is...
Like, what a change, right? From the guy that was this little egg, like, I don't know, God. Yeah. And now he's like...
Hiding to, like, you want to face me?
Right? Oh, and this... And it's fun because his life story is in, it's in three chapters, 6, 7, and 8, and that's it. And we see a lot of that fast forward in terms of like what he does, but it's like, boy, this guy, he's a different guy at the end of his life. Not because he's anything that he wasn't, but he didn't see that. God calls that out of him and says, man, you're the guy that I'm going to use. Okay, I could have picked anybody, but the least and the last, I like those guys, right? So you know by looking at him, he probably wasn't impressive. He probably wasn't a guy that you'd pick out of a crowd and go, man, that's our guy. He was just some dude, right? You know, and that's what God likes. But boy, his heart is big. He's got some panache, if you will. So he's not scared. Tore down their altar, or the tower rather, in verse 17, in Penuel, and killed the men of the city. Okay. And now he's going to talk to Zeba and Zalmunna. Verse 18, read that. All right, now he's asking them, okay, look at up here. What type of men were the guys you killed at Tabor? Here's Mount Tabor right here. Okay, this is the valley. So, hey, in that battle that we fought and all those people that you killed, what type of guys were those that you killed? Okay, that's what he's asking. What kind of men were they? Okay, he's asking these enemy kings. And what is their response? They like you, each one resembling the son of a king. What's their response to Gideon? Now, just remember, these two enemy kings just watched Gideon put all these guys on the chalkboard, spank him for a couple hours, and then kill him. Okay, and now he turns to these guys and say, by the way, those guys that you killed back in my hometown, what kind of guys were those? And they say, Gideon, just like you, resembling the son of a king. They're kissing his butt, right? Literally, that's what they're doing. They were like, you, great and awesome, the son of a king. Why are they doing that? They're trying not to die, right? It's brilliant. Man, Gideon, you're awesome, right? And that's the response, okay? In verse 19, Gideon says, I don't need flattery. Keep going.
And he said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you have saved them alive, I would not kill you.
That actually was my hometown. Those were my brothers. Those were my people. That was my family who you killed. Had you not touched them, I may have let you live, but not so much, okay? Verse 20.
So the young man did not draw his sword. Oh, sorry. So he said to Jethro, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the young man did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a young man.
So he's going to give his son the honor of killing these two pagan kings. And guy says, you know, just like Gideon. He's scared. He's not ready. He's like, no. Okay. So now 21, here's a completely different response. Okay. Read that.
Then Zebah and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and fall upon us.
So what do they say? You kill us. Gideon's like, okay. Like, I don't know what they were expecting with that comment. Like, if you're a man, you kill us. And Gideon says, no worries. So Gideon arose, like, we didn't even get a whole verse on it. Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna. Done. Okay, and then he took the crescent ornaments, which were on their camels' necks. Okay, so he's going to strip them of their jewelry and all the stuff that their camels would have been had, all the, you know, all the stuff.
When did that battle happen?
Yeah.
Did they skip it, or
they would have been apparently with the Midianites in that original battle when they killed Oreb and Zeb. Apparently those kings were with them. Oreb and Zeb died at the hands of the Ephraimites. These two kings escaped, go back home, that were in that battle, and we just don't hear that portion of it. And Gideon says, oh, by the way, when you were there with Oreb and Zeb, what type of those were those guys that you just killed? And they didn't know, oh, that's actually your hometown.
When the Midianites were saying, why didn't you invite us earlier?
The Ephraimites said that, yeah, not the Midianites. Okay. Yeah. So apparently, okay, these guys joined forces with the Midianites to do that battle. The Midianite kings died, but these two kings survived and fled home with their armies. Okay, so they chased them all the way back. So
the battle took place in his hometown.
Yeah, so the battle is here. This is where it starts. Okay, so yep. In Manasseh. Remember I told you guys Manasseh got the sweet land, like from coast to coast, they had everything. This is Midian. This is Gideon's hometown, home tribe, if you will. Okay, so I don't think he lived right here, but that would have been his people, right? So that's his extended family. So that's what he basically says. You're going to die, okay? So he takes the crescent ornaments on his neck, okay? 22, how about this?
Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us. You and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian.
Where are they asking Gideon to be? Be their king. Now, have we seen this before? This is like not a king, like a judge, but they're saying, rule over us, you and your son. So start a kingly line. You be the guy. Just like, by the way, all the kings that we see around us. You see the influence? Where did they get that idea? Gibeonites have kings. These guys have kings. The Amalekites have kings. All these people that come in and attack us have kings. Gideon, you've won the battle. You're the guy. You be our king and all your sons. Let's have a dynasty. How about this for a response? Take this is, again, this is why God picks guys like this. 23.
Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you.
Wow. How many guys can say no to power like that? Be our king. We want you to be our king. No, God is your king. I'm saying no to power, no to prestige. Boy, that is difficult. The lifestyle, the glitz, and all that would have come with being a king. Gideon says, okay. Gideon said to them, I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil. Okay, so they took all these things that they had taken from the battle. Earrings, because of the Ishmaelites, apparently, that had all this stuff, like the camels that we mentioned earlier. They spread them out in verse 24. Every one of them giving them an earring, they threw them into the spoil. They weighed it all out. It was a grip of stuff. And in verse 27, now Gideon says, make it into an ephod. What is an ephod? Where have you seen that word before? Think Leviticus. The priests wear it. The linen ephod. That was the garment that they wore. and they placed it in his city, in Ophrah, which is where he's from. So they make this, Gideon makes something apparently for the priests, and in 27, they interpret this different. I don't think this is what Gideon meant based on the rest of his life, but it's an odd text. Jane, read that. So he means this, I think, best as I can tell, as like a tribute, probably to the Levites. He makes something for God in representing of like, this is your king, I'm not your king. And they take it and say, it's an idol, let's worship it, right? Let's have a Baal Ashtoreth party at this. So it's like, wait, that's not what I meant. So again, so like some of these altars clear. This altar or whatever he did was not clear, and the people I think had not the response that he wanted. Yeah.
What's the part about being Ishmaelites about it? Didn't it just say Israel?
The Ishmaelites were the people that they took the stuff from. So apparently, like up in verse 21, it says they took crescent ornaments. So this would have been from the trade routes that would have happened or whatever. Apparently, these pagan kings had taken stuff from other countries, and some of those spoils of their victory were from Ishmaelites, and that's why that got included. So crescent ornaments were also pagan signs of worship. So it's just kind of a weird deal. Like, was he trying to make a golden calf like Aaron was? It doesn't seem like it, but yet that's what happened. Okay. Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel. They did not lift up their heads anymore. Verse 28, the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Okay. We'll pick up on the rest of that story tomorrow. So it seems like that wasn't Gideon's heart, but they do something weird, and we'll pick up on the rest of that tomorrow. All right. So enjoy your Thursday. Breathe in lots of air today because it's good. Save some for later when it gets bad.